Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Says it's ready to enter serious negotiations about its disputed nuclear program as it faces next week's UN deadline to stop the program or face sanctions. But many of Iran's leaders say the nuclear program must continue as part of their overall scientific program. Boston Globe Middle East Bureau Chief Anne Bernard writes about this in the paper today. And Anne, you say that Iranian leaders say that producing nuclear energy will restore Iran's historical status as the mother of science. What do they mean by that?
They're harking back to an era when the Persian Empire was the leader of science worldwide, when Europe was in the Middle Ages and the Persian Empire was experimenting with mathematics and astronomy and translating world literatures. They look back at this time as their heritage, and they would like to see themselves reaching towards that greatness again.
And so what's its overall goal here? Is this a lot of rhetoric, or are there some specific things that the country wants to accomplish?
Of course, the government has tried to harness this very genuine sense of Persian or Iranian pride in science and education to their own ends to rally the public behind a nuclear program, which the government claims is for peaceful electricity-generating purposes, but which nuclear inspectors, the United Nations, and many countries believe is meant to produce nuclear arms. And this helps explain why so many Iranians support the program, even though it might bring sanctions or even a military attack. But it's unclear if the ordinary people who support this are really supporting the idea of nuclear weapons or more just the idea that Iran should be a technologically advanced country with nuclear power.
And they're proud in the overall science program that's going on in the country because they do have some unusual things that U.S. researchers might be envious of. Can you explain that a little bit?
This is one of the many things when you visit Iran, you find out it's so much more complex than it's often portrayed in American politics. Even though Iran is the first modern Islamic theocracy ruled by mullahs who have the final say and can order women to wear headscarves, paradoxically, Iranian scientists who work on human embryonic stem cells have more freedom than American scientists do. So a kind of scientific experimentation that many scientists think will lead to the cures for many diseases has run afoul in a way of the abortion debate in the United States. Whereas in Iran, the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has explicitly permitted work on human embryonic stem cells because he believes that this will help cure diseases and will make Iran a leader in science.
Where are the scientists in all of this? It sounds as if they might be caught in the middle somewhat in terms of being motivated, obviously, by this push for science, but also being concerned on the other hand.
Scientists in Iran obviously want to be part of an international scientific community. And the more Iran proceeds towards a confrontation with the West, the more they're afraid they may end up even more isolated than they are now. And, you know, let's not be too simplistic. Even though in the case of embryonic stem cells, because Muslim law suggests that a fetus doesn't have a soul until it's 120 days old, this is an opportunity for them to be more liberal than the United States on this issue. But in many other areas, scientists do feel official pressure to tailor their results to what the government wants, and sometimes even to include Islamic perspectives in fields that the scientists say have nothing to do with religion.
What about the Iranian public? I read that you wrote that when you talked with some members of the public, several giggled when they were reciting the government mantra, nuclear power is our indisputable right. So can we take from that anything about the success or non-success of the government's program to try to convince the public that it needs this nuclear program?
Well, again, it's a relatively sophisticated public, and many of them strongly support the idea that Iran should have the right to nuclear power, but they still also give a nod and a wink to indicate that the government is also pressuring them to support this view.
All right. Well, Anne, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Anne Bernard is Middle East Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. The United Nations-backed ceasefire in Lebanon is holding, but it's still described as fragile. Israeli soldiers and Hezbollah fighters have clashed several times since the ceasefire took effect last week, and negotiations continue about the makeup of an international peacekeeping force in Lebanon. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is under growing public pressure to approve an independent investigation of the war with the power to dismiss top officials. So, what is the view from Israel? Well, joining us to talk about that is David Horowitz. He's editor-in-chief and a columnist for the Jerusalem Post. Welcome.
Thank you.
In one of your latest columns, you write about what you call a malaise in Israel and a superficiality that you say can't be addressed by rolling a few key political and military heads. What do you mean by that?
Look, I think there's a concern in Israel that this war with Hezbollah caught the country unprepared, that militarily there was a great deal of overconfidence in the highest echelons of the military and politics that Hezbollah could be broken in a few days and then wiped away, which plainly turned out not to be the case. And I also think that Israel could have done much better in terms of articulating what it was confronting.
And how should Israel have framed its PR strategy in this case, do you think?
Well, I mean, this really has been a conflict essentially with Iran. Hezbollah is trained and armed and inspired by Iran. There were actually many Iranians, many hundreds of Iranians who have been fighting with Hezbollah. Iran brought this guerrilla terror group into Lebanon, which has taken over southern Lebanon, which built up this immense rocket capability, which was only for use against Israel. There is no territorial dispute between Israel and Lebanon. Israel pulled out to the international border 6 years ago. That borderline was certified by the UN. And I think Israel failed to stress any of those basics. But then, taking it further, what happened was that Hezbollah set up its rocket capability within residential areas, fired indiscriminately into civilian Israel and crowed over every civilian fatality in Israel, and then claimed foul when Israel, hitting back, inadvertently caused civilian casualties on the Lebanese side. I think Israel could have done more to make those truths inescapable.
When you talk about Hezbollah firing into civilian areas, and we hear from members of the military, there's a group of Israeli reservists who were involved in this fighting who say that the country was not prepared. We also heard Brigadier General, who's leaving, Yossi Hyman, say, you know, we were arrogant, and we all feel a sense of failure from all of this. How significant are these comments from the military to Israeli officials?
Well, first of all, he's probably been the most outspoken senior military figure to date.
Hyman.
Hyman. But I think he's tapping into something that much of the public feels. I think a part of the government believes that this conflict so far has been much more successful than much of the public feels. I think from some of those in government, there's a sense that, in contrast to previous border provocations by Hezbollah, this time Israel hit back. It proved it was not prepared to sit with its arms folded any longer. It pushed Hezbollah away from the border. It has now got the international community motivated to try and help curtail Hezbollah's activities in Lebanon. But I think much of the public, and certainly some in the military, feel that that is a slightly rosy, spectacled way of interpreting what's actually happened, and that Northern Israel spent a month in bomb shelters as thousands, literally thousands of rockets bombarded the country. The reservists were called up and answered the call with 100% alacrity. In other words, I think even more people than were called in some cases pitched up to their units. And there was a sense that there was a very wide consensus in Israel behind a war that was intended to put Hezbollah out of business as a military force. And that a combination of government inexperience, perhaps, or reluctance, concern about death tolls and so on, and an overestimation in the army about what could be done from the air meant that Israel did not decisively prevail in this conflict. And that means, I think, again, for much of the public, that this is only round one of a conflict with Hezbollah. There's a concern that this international force is really not going to prove terribly effective. And since Iran is led by a president who is daily telling the world that he wants to wipe out Israel and is also daily moving closer to a nuclear capability, there is certainly no sense, I think, in the mainstream of the Israeli public that things are working out to Israel's advantage at the moment.
So then what are the main lessons that Israel should take from this if it is round one, aside from having perhaps a better PR campaign and an improved ability to articulate exactly what's going on?
Well, I think there are lessons to be learned in all sorts of areas. There are very specific military reallocations, I think, that have to go on. There has to be greater training of reserve forces and greater insurance that when the reserves are called, they're properly equipped and properly organized, because that plainly was not the case everywhere this time. Israel needs to find some kind of answer to the short-range missile threat. They are very, very hard to counter, and they can probably only be countered by ground forces at this stage, but Israel certainly needs to find better ways of grappling with that. I think that the notion that sort of conventional warfare was a thing of the past has been shattered by the nature of this conflict. I think also diplomatically and PR-wise, Israel needs a strategy, because I think the degree of room for maneuver that the international community grants Israel, the degree of criticism that Israel faces, are hugely influenced by the way people perceive the rights and wrongs of a conflict. And I think for the future, since Israel has been prepared to compromise on issues of territory, it needs to create a climate where, if its sovereignty is nonetheless threatened or in this case actually breached, there is greater understanding when Israel needs to defend itself.
Should there be negotiations with Syria?
The mainstream sense in Israel is that you would be rewarding a regime in Syria that has been crucial to the arming of Hezbollah. At the same time, there are people and people quite high up in the Israeli government who are saying the opposite. A very serious political player in Israel, Avi Dichter, who was the former head of the Shin Bet security service, has been saying that Israel should open talks with Syria and should be looking for a deal with Syria under which it would relinquish the Golan Heights. The Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, is saying the opposite, and I think that's the majority conception at the moment.
Hmm. What about in terms of other lessons that Israel may take from all of this, and what lessons Israel's enemies may have learned from this conflict?
I'll answer the second part first. I think the concern that about lessons learned by Israel's enemies is that for more than a month, northern Israel was bombarded with rocket fire, and Israel proved, for whatever reason, incapable of stopping that fire itself. I'm concerned that the Palestinians, the Iranians, Israel's existential enemies, wherever they may feel, well, if we were able to do this by firing at Israel from one front, we already have a degree of a missile capability from Gaza, which has been used, of course, against Israel extensively. If we can now get at some kind of missile capability from east, remember, Israel is always in the headlines and makes an awful lot of noise, but it is tiny. It is 9 miles wide at its narrowest point. If Israel is threatened by missiles already from the north, already from the south, add one more front, then the Israelis will have nowhere to flee to. I'm concerned that that is a lesson that some of Israel's enemies may be tempted to learn, and therefore I think it's crucial that Israel finds both diplomatic support and military abilities to respond to that threat.
We're talking with David Horowitz of the Jerusalem Post about Israel taking stock of the war with Hezbollah. Horowitz argues that Israel needs to make profound changes and should revisit traditional Jewish values in order to survive. Stay with us. There's more on that coming up here and now. Role, but it said today it will withhold troops if Israel does not respect the ceasefire. We've been talking about the mood in Israel with David Horowitz. He's editor-in-chief and columnist for the Jerusalem Post. And David, right before the break, you said you did not think that it was crucial that there be resignations in the wake of the war. But what about Defense Minister Peretz? Should he resign?
It seems to me that Mr. Peretz was a reluctant defense minister in the first place. He didn't really want to be the defense minister. He didn't have a military background. He stressed very strongly in the election campaign, where he was the leader of the Labour Party going into these elections and hoped to be the prime minister. He stressed that he would be looking to other people for defense expertise. It wasn't his field. He took the job because of the particular curious nature of Israeli coalition politics. I imagine he would not wish to step down, but I don't know how that's going to pan out. But the point that I would want to stress here is that I don't think it's a matter of a particular personality having been crucially at fault here. I think that there is there was a wider lack of preparedness, and there is still a wider inability to competently struggle for Israel, not merely militarily, but also in terms of world public opinion and world diplomacy.
But do you think the government is weakened because of that?
I think the government is plainly, I mean, you don't need me to tell you that. If you look at opinion polls in the last few days, you had an incredibly popular government, prime minister, defense minister, chief of staff, while the war was being fought. Part of that, of course, is the natural patriotism of a nation under attack. But also it was a broad endorsement of what were the declared aims of this conflict, including the defense minister's insistence that Israel was going to break Hezbollah. And the popularity has dropped, it has plummeted since the guns fell silent, because the public feels that between the top echelons of government and the top echelons of the military, the war was not fought in a way that ensured the decisive victory that I think much of the public felt was needed. So the government has certainly lost popularity. But what I was going to say was that there needs to be some kind of serious inquiry into the lead up to this conflict and the flaws in the preparation for and the waging of this conflict, which is not about whether this or that politician or military general resigns. It's about a wider level of preparation and a wider level of strategizing, and I think the lessons of this conflict are more important, and the consequences of this conflict are more crucial for Israel than can be solved simply by one or two people losing their jobs or resigning.
You also write that you say essential Jewish values, the values that have sustained the Jewish people for so long and through so much, must be revisited because the survival of Israel may require some compromises. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I used exactly those words, but I think Israel has, I mean, it's incredibly ironic for many of us in Israel to feel that we are tremendously criticized by a watching world for alleged, purported, exaggerated use of force, whereas most people in Israel, myself certainly included, feel that Israel overwhelmingly is restrained, has brought nothing like its potential military force to bear in many of its conflicts, and has striven to minimize civilian fatalities of enemies that are striving to maximize ours. I interviewed the head of the Air Force a few weeks ago, before this conflict with Hezbollah, and he was talking about how Hamas rocket cells profit from that awareness of Israeli restraint. He spoke about people going off to fire Qassam rockets into Israel intended to kill Israelis, literally holding the hands of their children, because they know the Israeli Air Force, which may be able to hit them from the air, will not fire at them because they're holding their kids' hands, and therefore they fire into Israel with impunity. And I endorse the moral basis for that restraint. I think it's wonderful that Israel is so concerned about preventing civilian fatalities that it would potentially put its population at a degree of risk. But I think the issue here is of balance, and the issue here is of the stakes, and the issue here is of killing or being killed. And by the way, I'm not sure that this requires an abandonment of Jewish values at all. What I think it might require is a reassessment of what Jewish values require, because I think that Judaism places human life at the very peak of values. It is the Jewish imperative to avoid the taking of life at almost all costs, and yet there are circumstances where I think Jewish values would require that if somebody rises to kill you, that you ensure they're not able to do so. And it was in that kind of context that I was writing.
One last question that I'd just like to double check with you, David. The soldiers that were captured that started a lot of this violence, the Israeli soldiers, they are still being held by enemies of Israel. How is that affecting public opinion of all of this?
Well, first of all, the public sense of an indecisive, at best, end to this war is partly fueled by the knowledge, as you rightly say, that the two soldiers who were kidnapped at the start of it and a third soldier who's being held in Gaza, as far as we know, they have not been returned. And it was certainly one of the declared aims of the government responding militarily to get these soldiers back. The way the conflict developed, I wouldn't say that it overshadowed or marginalized the fate of those soldiers, but we then were brutally forced to appreciate the strength that Hezbollah had managed to build up, And therefore, the issue of the soldiers is still a central issue, but there is now a wider issue of the ongoing need to grapple with Hezbollah militarily and to grapple with its patrons, most especially in Tehran, militarily, if necessary, if there isn't a concerted international diplomatic effort that reduces Iran's potential threat.
David Horowitz, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post and author of several books, including Still Life with Bombers, Israel in the Age of Terrorism. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, religious groups are closer to power than they ever have been in U.S. history. But an evangelical Christian asks, are they doing what Jesus would do? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K to 12 nationwide.
30-year-old sprinter says she's shocked by the results, and she could be barred from track and field events for 2 years if a second sample tests positive. This comes after American cyclist Floyd Landis tested positive for elevated levels of testosterone during the Tour de France. While public attention has been focused on the alleged doping of athletes, author John Hoberman says there is widespread use of performance-enhancing drugs by the rest of America, everyone from cops to college students. John Hoberman is author of Testosterone Dreams, Rejuvenation, Aphrodisia, Doping, and he joins us on the line from Austin, Texas. Welcome.
Thank you.
John, you researched the use of performance-enhancing drugs for several years now, 30 years, I believe. How widespread is the use of these drugs among Americans?
It is more widespread than most people are aware. For example, police officers use anabolic steroids. There are incentives for people in that profession to be big, to have muscle mass, to be able to summon up extra aggression. It would be very surprising, in fact, if there were no police officers using anabolic steroids, along with prison guards, bouncers, security people. The Australian military has experimented with anabolic steroids for special forces. So you're talking about niche markets, substantial niche markets, for certain kinds of performance-enhancing drugs that are notorious when they're used by athletes, but generally ignored when they're used by other kinds of workers.
You also talk about students using Ritalin and Adderall. Are you talking about the drugs that are prescribed to students for things like ADHD, or what are you talking about there?
In this case, you will have some kids with prescriptions. And what happens in a dormitory, for example, or perhaps on a high school campus, is that a black market emerges in which the kids with the prescriptions will sell their drugs to their schoolmates or classmates for $3, $5 a pill, whatever it happens to be. So in this case, medically legitimate drugs find, in effect, a second career outside the law in performance-enhancing roles. It's essential that we keep in mind that these parallel universes of drug use are typical of our society.
And what do you think that means, that they're typical of our society?
It means that we have, as a population, a much larger appetite for what you might call functional or utilitarian drug use than we are willing to admit. I mean, the peculiar situation we find ourselves in is that we tend to scapegoat certain kinds of drug use. The elite athletes are our principal scapegoats in this regard. The social scorn is heaped upon them, whereas all sorts of other subpopulations are using lots and lots of caffeine or Prozac or testosterone replacement or growth hormone. Everybody who knows my work knows that I do not favor athletes doping themselves with drugs. But public rituals of humiliation that elite athletes caught doping are put through constitute a distraction which really costs us a lot of understanding as a society of our own pharmacological habits.
So you're not necessarily saying we should crack down on everyone equally necessarily, but maybe stop being so judgmental of athletes in these situations because they're like other competitive people in our society who are using these things in a way that is seemingly more acceptable.
Yeah, I think that if we really want to understand most of the athletes who become notorious because they've used doping drugs, you have to understand that this is workplace doping, that these are people who are using drugs to keep their jobs.
But you also write about ubiquitous cans of Red Bull at many offices, even coffee. What's wrong with those? I mean, where would you draw the line here and what's considered a performance enhancer?
My point is not necessarily to say that it is wrong to use caffeine to stay awake and perform your job more effectively, as many, many people apparently feel they need caffeine in order to get up in the morning and work efficiently. The point is rather to, again, avoid the selective indignation and judgmental attitudes that, for irrational reasons that really don't make sense, are going to stigmatize one practice, often demonize, in the case of anabolic steroids, whereas other drug-taking populations get a free pass. We need to think harder about the standards that we apply to judging our pharmacological practices.
And you think that would help if we look at things equally, these performance enhancers equally?
Yeah, to look at each of them in its role as a utilitarian drug that boosts productivity. I mean, productivity, in a way, is the key to the way drugs are judged and stigmatized or not stigmatized. My theory says that there are important roles that anabolic steroids play in our society, which escape scrutiny precisely because people don't want to give up what are assumed to be the productive effects of these drugs.
Would you ever, yourself, use anything that you think would enhance your productivity? Coffee, Red Bull, anything like that?
I don't use any of those caffeine products, but your question raises a disturbing hypothetical question, and that is, what if, as an intellectual worker, which is what I am, who is very concerned about his productivity, I were to discover that unless I took a drug that boosted my brain function, I would not be able to compete in the intellectual marketplace. What would I do? Where is the system of ethics that could support me in the decision to abstain from brain-boosting drugs? This, by the way, is a dilemma that has already been lived many, many times by elite athletes. If you want to perform in certain sports at the Olympic level that is going to make you any money, get you any sort of recognition, you have simply had to take drugs. That's why the Tour de France peloton is soaked with drugs, because these guys don't want to lose their jobs. They don't want to work in factories or as street sweepers. They would much rather earn a decent living on their bikes and maybe even have a shot at getting famous for a little while. So it's the functionality of the drug that is the key to the whole issue.
Thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
John Hoberman is author of the book Testosterone Dreams, Rejuvenation, Aphrodisia, Doping. He spoke with us from Austin, Texas. And still to come, a story of a swimmer who found herself sharing the water with a baby whale. You're listening to Here and Now. In an attempt to prevent airline terrorist acts, the Transportation Security Administration is experimenting with a new passenger screening technique. Specially trained officers watch passengers' faces and their body language for signs that might suggest the passenger could be hiding something. A story about the program ran in last week's New York Times. In the six photographs that accompanied the story, the same woman was shown with different facial expressions. In one photo, her nose was wrinkled, suggesting disgust. In another, her upper eyelids were raised to indicate fear. Of course, artists everywhere learn to make their faces and bodies express emotions convincingly, particularly in classical Indian dance. We've invited noted Indian dancer Nina Gulati, who's founder and director of the Triveni School of Dance in Boston, to describe what she does when she's dancing and how she does it. Nina Gulati, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about this way that you portray emotions on stage and what you do?
Well, you know, in Indian classical dance, they say eyes are the windows of your soul. So whatever we feel within, we express through the eyes. Of course, the body and the hand gestures add to it. So if I showed anger through my eyes and added a slash with my hand and a stamp with my foot, that's emphasizing the anger. Yeah. Similarly, fear, usually you want to turn away from it. So it's regressing, and at the same time, the fear could be terror. It could be just nervousness about the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
So emotions are a very important part of Indian dance, and so we do learn to control every part of the facial muscle.
Yes, because the face can really, even very subtle things in your face can give things away, right?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, there were some things I read about that I thought were really interesting. Your eyelids moving close together are a signal of one thing.
Yes, they do. They can, and not just the eyelids, the eyebrows, and of course the central, the cornea is the one that's penetrating. You know, when you show anger, you can see the whites of the eye.
Your eyes are opening
yes,
very wide.
Right. But it can be a different kind of anger where you squint your eye, you know, feeling it in and saying, oh, I'm going to get that person. But it's all through the eyes.
Let's choose something. For example, if you had to portray disgust, how would you do it?
Well, disgust, I mean, first my eyes will see something that is disgusting. And then, you know, whether it has a bad odor, then my nose would start to feel, you know, express how awful it is. Phew. And, you know, then you add to it anger that why was that awful thing put in front of me? You know, so the disgust can develop into contempt, anger.
Your mouth frowns almost in a way.
Yes, there is a frowning of the lips.
What do you think is one of the hardest emotions that you try to capture when you're dancing? What's difficult?
Well, in dance, the most difficult but the most important is what we call the bhakti rasa, or the devotional feeling, because that's not dramatic. It's something you feel within you. When a dancer feels that devotion, you can see it in her eyes. You know, you can see when a dancer is feeling it, and it's genuine, and when it's very superficial.
We are going to have photos of your many expressions on our website, so we will have that visual aid. But I'm wondering, because you've studied it so closely and tried to perfect this way of portraying emotions, does it help you read people better? Like, do you think you notice more when people are talking with you?
You know, I think I do, because I'm constantly watching. When I'm teaching, I am watching the face of the dancers all the time, seeing how their eyes are reacting to a feeling. I don't want them to use too much of the body. Do it more from the face, just like showing shyness, looking up and then down, rather than bringing your shoulders and crouching. Those sort of subtle things.
Indian classical dancer Nina Gulati talking about the emotions that dancers express on their faces. For pictures of how Nina Gulati expresses some of those emotions, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There is more ahead, here and now. Among other swims, she did two crossings of the English Channel, and she swam a mile off Antarctica in iceberg-filled waters. In her new book, Grayson, she tells another swimming tale, and while we don't want to give too much away, we can tell you it begins with Lynn wrapping up a day of training in Southern California and meeting a baby gray whale.
He was breathing. A white, heart-shaped plume of mist was shooting loudly 4 feet above the water through the two holes on top of his head. The air smelt salty and oily, quite different from the breath of minke whale, which smells like a cat's after a fish dinner. Treading water, I watched the baby whale. I couldn't take my eyes off him. He swam within 10 yards of me. He was huge, maybe 18 feet long, the length of a small sailboat.
That's Lynn Cox reading from her book, Grayson, the name she eventually gave that baby whale following her after he somehow was separated from his mother, and she joins us in the studio to tell the story. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, swimming in the ocean has been a part of your life for some time. You've encountered all kinds of creatures swimming. Why did this particular whale stand out for you?
Well, it was one of those unusual days when I was training off the coast of California and swimming in the early morning before dawn, so the water was pitch black. And I was just doing my normal workout, but suddenly I felt something really big swimming underneath me. And I couldn't figure out what it was. You know, at first I thought, well, maybe it's a seal. Then I thought, well, maybe it's a shark. And so I turned and swam closer to shore. It wasn't until I finally reached the Seal Beach Pier where the old man that ran the bait shop told me that you've got a baby whale who's following you. And if you go ashore, he will follow you and go aground and die. So you have to stay out in the water and help him find his mother.
And help him find his mother. In the wide, wide ocean.
Right, you know. But
small task.
Exactly. But, you know, it's sort of like when you see this stray dog on the street and you're thinking, okay, I have to park my car and run across the freeway or turnpike or whatever to get the dog to be able to get to see the tags to see if I can get him home. And so I swam all over the Pacific Ocean with this baby whale trying to find his mom. I wasn't alone, though, because there were lifeguards who knew me from my channel swimming and training and all that who were way offshore there. And then Steve, the guy that ran the bait shop, had radioed out to the fishermen, the boats way out there, and they started looking for the mom. And we sort of just spent a lot of time out there. But the scary part was that at times the baby whale would disappear. I swam about a mile and a half offshore where the water was very deep. And
So how long would you say you were actually in the water with the whale?
I'd say between 4 and 5 hours that morning. And actually that day I was just supposed to get in and do an hour workout and be done and then go, you know, do my homework and go see my friends. This story was written when I was 17 years old. And it's now sort of looking back 30 years later of how far do you go? How much do you hope? When do you give up? When do you move on? It's sort of like the encapsulation of life and all those things that are so important to the heart. And so what I tried to do is write about that experience from a standpoint that you're in the water right there with me and you're seeing this happening and you know that suddenly Grayson is diving under the water and you don't know if he's ever coming back again.
Now, when you say you swam a mile and a half offshore looking for Grayson's mother, normally how far away would you swim?
Oh, normally I swim about 40 yards offshore, and I swim parallel to the shore, and I am very aware of where I am in relationship to land because the fog could suddenly come in. Also, there's lots of boat traffic, and so for me to go that far offshore without a boat was not a smart thing to do. And actually, I wrote a lot about that, about, you know, the dumb things we do in our lives. And some things are dumber than others, but at the same time, it may seem dumb. It may be apparently really dumb. But if you don't do it, what would happen if you do nothing?
And, of course, not trying in this instance could have had horrible consequences for the baby whale.
Well, the baby whale would definitely have died if he did not find his mom, because the thing is that when they're that young, 2 or 3 months old, they're relying totally on their mother's milk. They have no other source of food.
Then how do they become separated then from their mother?
Well, they can be playing with some kelp, or they can, you know, nowadays it could be that there's so much boat traffic in an area that upsets their communications because they send out signals, they speak through the water, and if there's a lot of interference, on the line, they can't be heard or they can't hear each other. So that was a possibility that maybe the ship's sonar was interfering with their communication.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there are many people who are saying, you know, a stray dog is one thing, but a baby whale in the ocean, a mile and a half offshore, is something else. It maybe almost might seem too impossible to believe for some people.
I think that just because in my life I've done things that seem impossible to believe to start with. You know, when I was 15, I swam the English Channel and broke the world record for women and men. And at the time that I was doing that, people were sort of saying, well, a 15-year-old girl could never swim the English Channel. And then I did it, and my goal was to break the record, and it happened. So I think that when you set higher and higher goals for yourself, you're more willing, hopefully, to be open to what can be done and what can't be done. And maybe you try a little bit harder when somebody may not think of it as a possibility.
When you talk about the sonar and the communication among these animals, you've written about dolphins before in your other book as well. Do you think that there's some sort of feeling almost that helps you, in a way, communicate or understand what's happening with the animal?
I think that dolphins and whales are tremendously sensitive, and I think that they can pick up on what a person's doing, and they can also see. I mean, to them, I was probably really out of my element, and they probably thought, gee, she looks like a really bad swimmer. We need to help her out, you know?
They thought you were really bad.
I was really in trouble. So I think that they can sense. I mean, just like the sharks have the sensing device within their snout so they can detect electrical fields. Maybe their sonar is used to be able to detect how somebody's feeling. And we don't know, but we can perceive that there's an animal here who's lost and he's come to me for help. Mm. And just the same way, he trusted me not to hurt him in any way.
I'm wondering, didn't you almost want to touch the whale?
Actually, I did touch the whale, and it felt sort of like a cool portobello mushroom. But that was sort of this longing to, sort of like E.T., you know, you're reaching out and you want to touch. And I sensed that he felt my touch and responded to it and moved a little closer. But there's still that sense of, oh my gosh, this animal's 18 feet long and he's moving into me. Oh, wow. You know?
And I'm touching
and it. And I'm touching it.
Him.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Now, both of your books, Swimming to Antarctica and this one, Grayson, talk about swimming and swimming very long distances, and for those of us who don't swim as well as you do, very trying circumstances. Why do you think that you're more acclimated to water than most people?
I think it's because my parents started us swimming in the lakes of Maine when we were kids. We learned to swim really before we could walk. We were blowing bubbles. It was a fun thing to do, to play among the sunfish. And one day I had this opportunity to swim in a 3-mile swim off the shores of California, and it was sort of like coming home again, you know, being able to be in the open water and feel the water changing as it moved over my back and feeling my arms just reaching out with no wall in front. People say to me, aren't you bored when you swim back and forth out there? And it's like, oh my gosh, you know, that's like the least of what's going on, you know, because you're sort of dancing with the water. You're changing your stroke according to the waves and the wavelength and the curl of the waves. Sometimes your stroke gets shorter. Sometimes the water's so flat it's like ice and you're gliding along. And it's just beautiful to be out there.
Thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Swimmer and writer Lynn Cox's new book is Grayson. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now. How close is too close? An evangelical Christian says churches in the U.S. are in too tight with Washington. Also, the intelligence.